You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Shouldn't you be at work?
And Love. Oh, and Love, he's got a real chance now. Peter and Love.
John Walk will take the penalty.
Up goes Dion Dublin!
An own goal from Ruddock!
A four-back break here for Kiwabia.
Panister and Bruce in the queue again.
Bruce! Score!
Goal leg! Hit leg! Hit leg over the top! Back now!
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, and it happened!
No!
Hello and welcome to Quickly Kevin, Will He Score? I'm Chris Skull. Joining me as always, Josh Widdicombe.
Hello, listeners.
And the man who may or may not have flown Yuri Geller around Wembley in a helicopter, who knows? Leave me out of it, it's Michael Mudd.
Definitely didn't, because it didn't happen, hello.
There was only one person who used to fly a helicopter in the 90s, that was Noel Edmonds.
And Elton John at Live Aid. Do you remember, have you ever heard this story that Elton John, when the helicopter landed at Live Aid, he massively delayed proceedings because he wanted the chopper to turn off before he left in case it blew his toupee off?
No.
There you go. There's celebrity gossip.
But I think Noel Edmonds, this is another Live Aid helicopter story. I mean, why not? You don't want that context every day in your career. I think Noel Edmonds, you know Phil Collins?
Yeah, I've heard this rumour.
He played both Live Aids. He's the only person that played both Live Aids because he went on Concorde from London to Philadelphia and performed drums with Led Zeppelin at one of them, I can't remember which. A performance that was apparently so bad that to this day Led Zeppelin have not allowed the footage to be used ever again.
Yeah. It's a really rich and entertaining Google that.
Yeah, it's
true. They all say that.
But Phil Collins was taken to whatever airport it would be, Heathrow or whatever, in Noel Edmonds' helicopter.
Flown by Noel Edmonds.
Yeah. Flown by Noel Edmonds to the airport.
Can I just say that, you know, the American Live Aid, whenever I see, for me, that doesn't exist within the canon of Live Aid. It's like the third Home Alone film for me. It's like, I don't, the American Live Aid, I'm like, it's like the American Live Aid Sync Christmas single. I'm like, it's not part of the official Live Aid canon.
I couldn't tell you, I mean, I could hazard a guess, but I couldn't confidently tell you who played at the American Live Aid. You could guess that the big American stars, but was there a performance equivalent to, I suppose, Queen or U2 were the big ones, weren't they?
Well, the one I saw was Simple Minds. Simple Minds played. And I was like, oh, really? Was Simple Minds big enough? But also, it's a sham. When you look at the footage of the American Live Aid, it's like there's people all around the back of the stage. Like, it doesn't seem to be, like, the manager of Simple Minds is like just stood behind the drummer. You're like, this is a shambles. It looks like Woodstock. And then you look at Live Aid in London. It's like, this is professional. Like the whole set was on a wheel.
Anyway, we should say for this series, it's an 80s music podcast. So we're interviewing today John Taylor from Duran Duran. Hello and welcome to Series 8 proper. It's episode 2, but the first one's always a bit of a, what they call in the trade, a soft launch. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of pre-season training, just getting our eye in.
Yeah, exactly. And we are sharp, as you've heard from the last 3.5 minutes. It's actually my birthday today. Very exciting. I'm 38. Thank you. Anyway, so do you know what? Should we just get on with the 90s o'clock news?
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10 with Chris Skull.
Our top stories today. Chris Bart Williams solves the mystery of his small feet. And also, Chris Bart Williams reveals whether or not he tied his shoelaces up.
Oh, wow.
So, friend of the show, Matt Ford, had Chris Bart Williams on his Nottingham Forest podcast. Do check it out. It's called Reservoir Red Dogs. He had Chris Bart Williams.
Let's be honest. If you don't support Nottingham Forest, is anyone checking it out? As much as I love Matt Ford's football-based output, I don't know. Have you ever listened to a different club's podcast?
No. No.
Only for research, but never out of choice.
Research ahead of a game for Manchester United, or research for this?
Yeah, yeah. Do you not know I'm Manchester United's chief scout? Most of my info from podcasts about the opposing team. Those guys really know their stuff.
When I used to do a podcast just about West Ham, I would get emails from fans of other clubs going, I don't know why, but I listened to this podcast. You're like, are you mad?
It's like when we get people who listen to this that aren't aware of the 90s football, I suppose. Yeah. I suppose, you know.
Same.
There we go.
Do you want to hear what Chris Bart Williams said after this line of questioning from Matt Ford?
Oh, yeah. Have we got a clip?
Yeah, here we go.
Chris, I've got to ask you about your boots. Firstly, is it true you used to play with your laces undone?
Correct.
Why?
Because the top where you tie it, I used to get a lot of pain there. So when I found that you could tie it without coming off, I was good to go. Now, I got threatened by numerous managers that if it came off, there was going to be trouble. And ironically, no one ever stood in the back of my heels for it to come off. That was number one. And two, I guess I had two pairs of socks, so it just never came off.
Right, can we stop like that? So he's running around without his laces done.
Yeah, it never came off.
In a professional football, they never came off. And he's swinging his leg at a ball.
What if shoelaces are just a construction? They're a lie. We've all been gamed. This is like the Matrix. You don't need shoelaces, guys.
Has he cut his laces short so that he couldn't trip over them in that sense? And then he's put on two pairs of socks to just keep his shoes on with like surface tension or what?
The ramifications of that little interview are mind blowing. Just bin your shoelaces. You don't need them.
But I've worn shoes.
All right, don't show off.
and I've worn shoes, and you do need to do up your shoelaces.
Chris Bart Williams says his shoes don't come off. I don't know what more evidence you need.
Is he running at such pace that they're kind of kept on by kind of
like that sort of, what is it, like centrifugal kind of movement where like physically it's impossible if you run as quick as he does. Or he's got odd shaped feet so that there is a width to length ratio that means that the boot stays on because of the side.
Well, you know, Christopher Williams has one extra little toe that pokes out, and so all his boots are custom, and it's that extra little toe that's keeping the boot on. It hooks on like a rivet. Do you want to know whether Chris Bart Williams has small feet or not?
Yeah, well, it would be absurd if he did at this stage.
Okay, here we go. Next question.
And is it true your boot size was size 5?
It was size 6.5.
Because that seems quite small.
It's very small.
I'm a 7.
There you go. Start talking after that. 6.5.
6.5.
That's small. I'm surprised. Yeah. That's the same size as my girlfriend's feet.
And how tall is she?
Is your girlfriend Chris Bart Williams?
Sorry, but I mentioned that before. Could have solved this mystery 3.5 years ago.
So he has got small feet. We've finally established that. Can I ask you before the next podcast, Chris, as the person that believes this, to A, see whether you could move a ball with your mind, and B... Could you go and run around the park kicking a ball without your laces done up and see how it goes? And could you record yourself chatting about how it's going as you do it? And we'll see in the next podcast how it's gone.
Okay, fine. I'm going to make a note of that.
Yeah.
Mission accepted.
Yeah. Say to Sophie, I'm really sorry, I can't do bedtime. You're going to have to put our daughter to bed. Obviously, I'd love to sit Chris Bart Williams down and go through the questioning again. Is he wearing shoes that are 6.5 and his feet are 6.5?
I feel like if he's having to wear two pairs of socks to make this work, he should just go down a size of shoes. Surely that's the better option.
Because they'll be cheaper, because I think he's only one size away from not having to pay VAT.
Yeah, that's a dream.
Right. Do you want the electronic post bag?
Let's go.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic post bag.
You've got mail.
Well, I know we've just had the jingle for the electronic post bag, but can we follow it with the jingle for Strange Hill, please? Okay, I vividly remember thinking this myself, but I didn't fall for it, but I did think about this. This is from Daniel McGee. Hello, chaps. For about a year in the late 90s, I kept hearing about the gifted Noel Williams. And assumed that the prefix that commentators and Goals Roundup shows had given him meant that he was the next big thing, one to keep an eye on. So that's what I did, waiting for Watford to come on in the Goals Roundup to see how the future England star got on that weekend. After quite a few months of this, I did think it was odd that he kept being referred to as gifted, as there were seemingly much better players in the division. Maybe the Goals Roundup man was a Watford fan, I thought. Even seeing Noel Williams on his back wasn't enough for the penny to drop in my 11-year-old mind. I figured he just liked being full-named and had asked the kit man for extra letters. It wasn't until a few more months later that I mentioned this player to my dad, to which he replied, "Sorry, what did you say?" I elaborated, "You know, that Watford striker, the gifted Noel Williams." Cue hysterical laugh from my dad, an explanation that his name was Gifton Noel Williams, and that he wasn't particularly gifted. Anywho, whenever he popped up on screen again, I got a, there's that gifted Noel Williams. He looks a real player for my dad. I had that as well with Gifton Noel Williams. Do you remember? Did you have that?
Yeah, it is a bizarre, it's a weird name, isn't it? There's something about the amount of like syllables in it. It just blows my mind.
Yes.
I would also file Gifton Noel Williams in the same file of as Jan Vanegor of Hesselink. I know that's a bit noughties, but oh, do you remember that?
Yeah, Jan Van Henegor, what was it?
was it Jan Vanegor of Hesselink?
Yeah.
Just a name where you're like, if you ever saw it come up on Championship Manager, you'd be like, is this a mistake?
Well, I wonder whether if anyone has ever made the same mistake with Angel Di Maria, where they're just like, oh, perhaps he's just a really lovely and well-behaved man, that Angel Di Maria.
Yeah.
Someone's gonna message in and go, it's Angel. But come on.
Can I say just quickly on Jan Vinegar of Hesselink? You know, like in Championship Manager, like you could never, you in your mind, you would imagine what these players look like because you couldn't see them. So like Ibrahim Bakayoko, you'd have no idea what he looked like, but you'd have a rough idea, for example. Or Nicholas Alexanderson, you kind of imagine. Yeah. With Jan Vinegar of Hesselink, in my mind, he always looked like Viggo the Carpathian from Ghostbusters 2. You know what I mean? Like that. It's not about that name. It sounds a bit like Viggo the Carpathian. And so in my head, he was the baddie from Ghostbusters 2.
Email in. What? How did you picture Championship Manager players? Also, on Jan Vanegor, whatever he is, poshest named footballers, Plymouth in the 70s and 80s had a player called Forbes Phillipson Masters.
Sounds like a university challenge team.
I don't know if he was any good, Forbes Phillipson Masters, but I wonder whether he did come from good stock, as they would say.
So is Forbes his first name?
Yeah, Forbes Phillipson, and then Phillipson Masters is hyphenated. Oh, he must have had an absolute nightmare in the dressing room.
Remember another one as well? I don't even know how you pronounce his surname. Like, is it Bicente Lizarazu?
Yeah, Bicente Lizarazu, yeah.
Bicente Lizarazu, like the left back. In my head, I thought, that's really posh. I bet he's really
posh.
Did
you?
And almost like, I was like, is that a stage name? It's almost too good a name.
Lizarazu. I often split that into two in my head as Lisa Azu. Lisa Azu could easily be nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. And that was the first you heard of her.
And the last.
Do you remember the year Lisa Azu won the Mercury Music Prize?
Favourite names
of 90s footballers. One more, Strange Hill. This gets us into Do I Remember This Right as well, because they're both from Andrew Lees. His Strange Hill, it was widely accepted in the small Herefordshire village I grew up in the 90s, that Rush, as in Rush Keepers, was an abbreviation of Russian. This was fact. We would often very formally announce Russian Keepers today before an all-day park session started. There was about 10 regulars who played, and I cannot recall it ever being questioned. We all knew that in Russia, the keepers played an expansive role that would shame the so-called sweeper keepers of today. Mazy dribbles, popping up in the box, etc. We avidly watched Euro 96 and completely failed to notice the very normal role the Russian keeper played. I used to think it came from Ian Rush. I genuinely believed.
Why? Yeah,
really?
Because he was called Rush.
Is that wrong too?
What do you mean?
Yeah, but I just thought like Ian Rush was like the most famous footballer at the time. So the fact they were called Rush, I just thought it was like your keeper turns into Ian Rush or something. I don't know.
Did you ever play, talking of sort of strange and funny rules, I just remembered a thing we used to play, like Rush Keepers, but it's called Spider Keepers.
Yes, Spider, where anyone could be in goal.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I'd heard.
So what, anyone could be in goal?
So basically, like, the whole team would attack. Whoever was around the goal at that point, if someone took a shot, anyone could just handle it, basically, to stop the goal.
Oh, wow. That wouldn't be a good rule in professional football. I was just thinking with that, it would just lead to less goals.
That worked. What was Rush? Rush keeper meant you could just come out beyond your area, right? So but I mean, that's like a normal real football has rush keepers.
What is rush keepers? Yeah.
It was more beneficial when you were playing like five or six a side. I think on a big pitch, there's no real benefit. But if you're playing like in a cage on five a side, your keeper being able to bring the ball out so that you draw a man towards you, it means you've overloaded the opposition. You've got a pass on basically.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize this was the Athletic. but Michael, I think the rule on rush keepers is you'd shout rush keeper and then someone else would sub into the goal for you.
No, that's a version of spider keepers. My understanding was that rush keepers, the keeper was always the keeper. It just means he could come out of the area with the ball, which obviously is allowed in 11-a-side, but you're very rarely in your local park playing 11-on-11.
I think we should do a Twitter poll and we'll put up some descriptions of what we think rush keepers is. Is it just a keeper being allowed out? Is it someone having to sub in for them? We'll just start a Twitter thread. We'll start a thread somewhere on the chat room and get to the bottom of this. So, guys, you know we've previously discussed Gary Mabbott's appearance on The Queen's Nose?
Yeah.
Yes.
Jack Stanley writes, I'm sure it's been brought to your attention that Gary Mabbott appeared in the 90s kids show The Queen's Nose, correct? What is bugging me, though, is what I remember the storyline. I can't remember the character's name, but I'll do my best. The main character has a coin that grants wishes. Either of you want to fill us in on the name of the character?
Oh, man.
Harmony. In this episode, she has only one wish left and has a choice whether to cure her relative of an illness or for her friend to play football with Gary Mabbott. Imagine the shock when a full kit Mabbott shows up for a kickabout. Is that the storyline? Her friend has an illness, and the other option is another friend wants to play football with Gary Mabbott. And Jack Stanley is claiming that the episode ends with Harmony choosing the Gary Mabbott option.
That's not true. Simply not true. Surely.
It's originally based on a book, The Queen's Nose. So if I don't know whether this is a speculative episode or whether... Or whether it's part of the book series that they've... I doubt Gary Mabbott was the first name they asked, if we're honest with ourselves. I'd love to get to the bottom of this. If anyone knows whether the episode revolves around someone being left ill in a hospital bed, or however, because someone else wants to play football with Gary Mabbott. I'd always presumed it was like a kid that's losing a football match and wants to win and wishes for a footballer when Gary Mabbott shows up.
Yeah.
Gary Mabbott is such a weird booking when you think about it. It's one of those where it's like someone who worked on the show must have known Gary Mabbott.
Yes.
You're not picking up the phone book and going, someone get me Gary Mabbott.
It can't be. It can't be. One more very quick one for Michael. This is from Mike Beardsworth, not the only person that emailed in about this. Michael's very quick no to the question, I don't know if you remember Dennis Bailey, didn't convince me.
Oh, God. Here we go. Oh, has he chipped Peter Schmeichel?
Bailey scored a hat-trick at Old Trafford in a 4-1 win for QPR on the 1st of January 1992.
Ooh.
He's memorable as the last opposition player to score a league hat-trick there. Can you name the only opposition player to score a league hat-trick there outside of the league since then?
Probably Ronaldo.
Yes, it was Ronaldo. But not only that, but it was New Year's Day and the match was live on ITV. Mike adds, I find it difficult to believe that Michael wasn't watching. I watched this game. I vividly remember. This is quite a big game from the annals of football because this would have been the last year of Division One. And I remember, I didn't know it was Dennis Bailey had scored the hat-trick, but I knew a player, I knew QPR had won 4-1 at Man U, and it was quite a big deal. Do you remember this at all, Michael?
I have a vague memory of the game, but I couldn't have told you for love or money who had scored that hat trick, or if anyone had indeed scored a hat trick.
Fair enough, Michael. I believe you.
Can I say, like, I'm a BBC man when it comes to World Cups and FA Cup. Like, if there's a choice, I will always watch the BBC. Like, and for me, ITV, yeah, bit of Champions League on Tuesday night, that works for me. But one thing that's missing, I think, is like the ITV Sunday lunchtime kickoff. Like, I don't know what New Year's Day, but there is a place in my heart for ITV showing live football on a Sunday lunchtime.
Yeah, totally. Totally agree. One of the things that I really, really hope they don't keep from coronavirus is the insane kickoff. You know, the insane kickoff times now is heartbreaking for me as a traditionalist. I didn't vote Brexit so that we could kick off at 8 p.m. on a Sunday night, mate.
Voted to keep those bloody foreigners out, didn't you? I have mixed feelings about the sort of football schedule for the last year, because I probably haven't watched as much football in such a long time, but I'm so disengaged with it. It's basically become like elevator music. It's kind of background wallpaper, unless it's a Manchester United game. But I'm watching, you know, when there's five games on in the day, I'm watching five games, and sometimes I'm watching like German football and Italian football in the gaps.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm emotionally dead to it.
It hates to be controversial, but I like...
Yeah, but we are fourth. That's the reason. Right, let's bring on our guest, Chris.
Yes, I mean, I love like, the texture of story you get when you meet people from different clubs and different backgrounds and, you know, fans who follow so-called smaller clubs. But what was fascinating about this interview about to hear is that we're about to hear from a Swiss player, a really, you know, accomplished Swiss player.
Decorated,
who came to England with a fresh pair of eyes in the mid-90s and just walked into that Gerry Francis-led dressing room and was exposed to what he perceived to be rank levels of unprofessionalism.
I would describe this as peak Quickly Kevin in its content. Yes. It's absolutely, as an interviewee, I would say Ramon Vega is absolutely in our wheelhouse.
And
he knew what we wanted, and he absolutely provided it in spades.
Let's get into it. Without further ado, here he is, the man himself, Ramon Vega. Today's guest is a cult icon of 90s football and beyond, fluent in five languages, a cultured Swiss defender with 23 caps for his country in spells at Grasshopper, Cagliari, Spurs, and a treble-winning time with Celtic. It's our pleasure to welcome to Quickly Kevin, Ramon Vega. How are you doing, Ramon?
Very well, guys. How are you guys doing?
Great. Very good.
Good.
I'm still in shock at how Chris pronounced Cagliari, but we'll have to move on from that.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say, he missed the Cagliari, the way he said it. But anyway, I'm glad to be on the show, guys.
And we said before the recording, you said any guide, and we said to focus on the kind of unprofessional elements of the 90s, and you said that's... Your words were 99% of it was unprofessional.
Yeah. Be honest with you, yes, frankly, that. Well, I just give you a story. When I was playing in the Serie A in Italy, as you say, Cagliari, okay? and there, you know, in Serie A in the 90s, you might know, it's definitely without a doubt the best league in the world, the best players in the planet were playing there, from the Brazilian Ronaldo, Batistuta, Zidane, you name it, you know, were on there. So when I joined Spurs in 96, 97, it was an enormous shock in the system to parallels between how professional was in the Serie A compared was in England. That was like just a joke, to be honest with you. There was not even a gym, let's call it, to exercise. I remember the first 2 days arriving in the training ground, the physio giving me a David Lloyd card. And I was like, what is David? First of all, I was foreign. I had no clue. And there was this Swiss guy coming to England, joining the club. The physio, here's your David Lloyd card. And he said, first of all, I had no clue with David Lloyd card. Of course, I know now. Well, there's a gym around the corner, around Chigwell, you know, in Essex there, you know, that was a David Lloyd centre. And he said, what is David Lloyd? So I talked to all the players. Where is this David Lloyd? Where's the gym? What do you mean, the gym? And we haven't got a gym here in the training ground. No, no, it's about, yeah, about 5K or something with the car and everything else. So I go to this David Lodge. It's a completely public gym. You have to go and you train on yourself. And I said, what the heck is that? So from that point of view, from having a training coach, a fitness coach in Italy, dietitians with them on a daily basis, the vitamins, everything, to none of that.
Wow.
David Lloyd's car, go train yourself, make sure you're fit on a Sunday. Pretty much, that's...
How yeah. often were you going to that gym with people? And were there people in that gym going...
I never went about once.
Well, I was going to say, I used to go to that gym, the David Lloyd in Chigwell. Yeah, I used to go to that gym.
This is the one where...
I never saw you there.
But that's why... I was more in the steamer or the sauna, I'll be honest, here using
it. It was a good steam. They did have a good steamer.
That's the only thing, but I have never used it. And it was like, for me, a completely different world. And either that, the whole system, the way you've been educated as a Swiss footballer in Switzerland is already, they were already well educated in terms of you have to look after your diet, to fitness, and you have to fitness coach, train you and educate you. In Italy, it's even more professional now. To completely non-assistant, nothing been helping you. It's pretty much you have to do your own program. And that was a new experience, let's say that way.
That's amazing. Did you say to any other players, this is madness, or was it ever...
Well, they didn't know anything else. That's what I've been pretty much used to. So for them, me training before a training session, half an hour before, go for a run and everything else, this is, you know, Roman, you're crazy, you're mad, what are you doing? It's a rumor. I have to warm up. For them, it's like, and I just, this is another point from sort of culture point of view, you know, when I arrived and they say, I was in Italy, 10 o'clock was training session, okay? So in Italy, you go already about 8, 8:15, you're already there. You start to get maybe warm up, stretching session, or massage and all that stuff. Okay. So when I joined Spurs, the first couple of weeks, I was like 8 o'clock there, the only one, nobody there, not even the physio was there. I was like, this is impossible. In 2 hours, we have training session, nothing is here. By around 8:30, 9 o'clock, maybe the physio slowly just. Slowly walking into it, you know, good morning kind of scenario. He said, hey, listen, it's 9 o'clock, in an hour I've got session. No players. 9:30, no players. 9:45. First player comes in with a cup of tea and a biscuit. Hola, mate. All right. Are you okay today? And I said, we're 50 minutes. We need to be on the thing. Well, no, bro. I've got my boots on. We go out. That was my kind of first 2 weeks introduction in England football.
Wow.
So it was not, of course, not all of them, but pretty much kind of that was my introduction. And so, goodness me, I made the club the first one. And the first one actually arrived from this player, 9:45 before, 50 minutes before for the training session. And that's hence the fitness of them were very limited, obviously. Yeah. As you can see, in first half, they were full fit. By the second half on a game, you can immediately the whole level of fitness went down, and that's where you're actually using also the game. But it has of course improved now, you know.
Yes,
but that was the 90s arriving to England in 95 96.
Do you know what, it's a shame it's improved. It was better then, Ramon. It was better. It was more fun. We'll come to Spurs, but let's go back to the start of your career. Do you know what, we always like to start with a quick quiz question, which is just to see whether you've been paying attention to your career. We like to ask all our footballer guests, can you name the shirt sponsors you've had throughout your career? Grasshoppers, Cagliari, Spurs, and then Celtic. We won't make you do Watford.
Wow. Grasshoppers, right. We had Nissan.
Yes.
We had various ones. Nissan. We had then... Bertorelli,
yes,
Italian,
Beretta.
Yeah, the salami producer, in Italy.
And then Cagliari.
Oh gosh. Cagliari was Italian cheese. Goodness me.
That is correct, an Italian cheese.
Yes.
Pecorino, something like that.
Yes. Wow. Pecorino sardo.
Sardo. fantastic, by the way.
Just did you get free cheese?
Oh, of course, mate. Swiss cheese, free cheese, mate. But this one was an Italian one, a very nice one from Sardinia. Beautiful flats, by the way, just to let you know. I really enjoyed that. So Pecorino, that was one. That
and
was
then Cagliari. Spurs.
Spurs was Hewlett-Packard.
Correct. Hewlett-Packard.
I think Hewlett-Packard, yeah. And then
Celtic.
I think it was only Hewlett-Packard that I played. And then Celtic. Oh, goodness me. NTL.
Wow, yes.
NTL,
Sambalana. This might be the first full house a footballer's ever got. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, some tough ones.
Have you kept all your shirts and stuff like that? Are you one of those people? Or?
Of course, that's why I need all the sponsorship. They're hanging, not above me, but in the next room, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, obviously, all the kind of great shirts, you know, from the 90s. As I say, some unbelievable players I play against, especially in Italy, you know, the Brazilian Ronaldo, the Battistuta, the Zidane, Boban Savicevic, Roberto Baggio.
Playing your position each week, you're the one manned with dealing with this legend,
best strikers,
basically.
Best strikers in the planet. Week in, week out in Italy. There was not one weekend you can have a breather. Really, every team in the Serie A at that time had at least one top striker in their team, if not two. Yeah. If you play against Inter Milan or AC Milan or Juventus, there's not even a question mark. They were just absolutely top players on the planet.
And does that excite you, or do you go, when you come to the Premier League, you're like, oh, thank God for that?
For me, listen... For me, as a centre-half, because, you know, as you know, defenders, the best defenders at the time was in the Serie A. And coming as a centre-half, be playing in the best league in the world, it was a major honour. It was first an excitement, and also very nervous. You suddenly, the ones you actually watch on TV, you suddenly have to mark on the weekend.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience. I still remember Sanzero walking out, and you've got Brazilian Ronaldo next to you, you've got Robbie Baggio next to you, and it's, goodness me, actually a year ago I just watched them on TV and I'm actually next to them. And
yeah,
and the quality, the sheer quality and respect you have for this player, as a player, as a professional, it's enormous. What I think maybe today is not that much respect anymore between the players. That's my view. You know, I think in the 90s it was, I think from character point of view, there are more men than now. Better attitude in terms towards the game, and I think the game was also much nicer to watch.
Yeah,
that's my view. Anyway,
no, you're on the right podcast if that's your view, Ramon. So you started out at Grasshopper Zurich, but when you're growing up in Switzerland, what kind of level were you compared to your peers? Because you hear about players when they're growing up, they were just so much better than everyone they were playing with.
It's a good question, because you don't see yourself always better than other ones. You just feel you're better than them. You know, you can't see it because somebody else has to charge on you if you're better than other ones. You know, and you can't have that arrogance, you need to have certain arrogance to be a professional, because that's the way it works in the industry. But you see it in school already. Prior to go to Brussels, because I was about 14, 15 years old, you know, and actually declined Brussels when I was 14, because I was in a small village called Drimbach, Olten. That's about half an hour outside of Zurich, okay? So Brussels was really calling me to go to the junior or the academy. And I simply said, no, I don't want. I want to be with my mates in my local little village. And Brussels looked at me and he said, is this guy mad? At that time, Russell was Zurich, it's just one of the biggest teams in Switzerland. Well, a title winner in Switzerland. Everybody loved to be just joining that club. And I just say no. So before they say no, then with 15, obviously they still insisted over the period of the next couple of years and coming. And then by 15, 16 years, then the Ottmar Hitzfeld at that time, my manager. So we need to have that youngster in our squad. And then that's what I then see. It was a little bit, obviously I matured a little bit more, because from 14 to 16, you go through a different phase and you have to start to realize Grasshoppers is calling now. You have a potential good opportunity to be a professional. And then, almost Vito had some one-to-one tests with him and some other players as well. And then I joined them as a club. And it was a big fight because my mother didn't want to start with because it was far away. Because I have go on the train half an hour. My mother was saying, well, you need to have an education or to forget football, frankly saying. So it was a big fight between the club and my mother. But if I look back, I thank my mother because thankful Russell but accommodated me into an education, like an apprenticeship. So if I look back, I wouldn't have anything of that. You just play football and that's it, simple as that. But I think she insisted so much, you know, that if I signed for Brussels, but this has to be part of the contract.
Well, one thing I'd really like to know is, what is football like in Switzerland? Is it the main sport of the country? Because for me, Switzerland is all about the Winter Olympics. I don't know. That's what it seems like on the outside. What is it like?
Well, actually, it's a good question because we changed that perception over the last 20 years now, or 30 years now, you know. When I joined the national team, that was pretty much after a year or two joining Grasshoppers by 17, 18 years old. Roy Hodgson was my manager at that time. He already called me up for the national team. But Switzerland, as you just mentioned at that time, was not on the map as a football country because first it was very small. So production of potentially good players are very limited. And as you mentioned, the main sport is skiing or hockey or any winter sports, you know. But then with Roy Hodgson, because he was one of the most successful managers, even today with Switzerland, qualify us for the 94 World Cup and those in 96. He put us completely different map in international football. And suddenly Switzerland accepted that we have some quality players, hence a lot of cool quality players went out to play in England, like Stefan Honschel, myself, in Germany, Stefan Chapuisat, Alan Suter, Sforza, some very good players, yeah. You know. We put pretty much the roadmap where actually Switzerland is today. You know, I think the other day, the under-21 just won against England.
Let's not go into that.
Well, I just needed to mention that. That's very important, you know. Small in the Switzerland, you know. Being thinking that, you know, the big nation of England, you know, is coming home. Yeah, maybe it's going away now.
So remember, we've established that English football was backwards by the time you came in, like, 97. Yeah. But so you worked with Roy Hodgson, yes, in, like, as the Swiss national manager. Yeah. So was Roy Hodgson ahead of his time in, like, the early 90s?
Yes, very much, very much, very much. In terms of... he actually put a roadmap within the Swiss football as a mentality, as especially mentality, because we are Swiss football, we thought we're a small country. We are, well, how can we compete with the big Germans, the Swiss, the Dutch, or the English, you know? We're not producing that. And he put us really, and actually the Federation, a really good roadmap. The youngsters believe in the quality of the talent we had in our staff. And he was a gentleman, first of all. And for an Englishman to speak all the languages, that was a rarity as well at the time.
Yeah. Did they love him in Switzerland then, Roy Hodgson?
Very much. He's a hero there. He's a legend. As a manager, he sent out also the national team as well. He had also Samax as a manager and also Grasshopper for Zurich. So in Switzerland, he's enormous, enormous kind of a hero and legend because he actually put Swiss football on the map. International.
Yeah. The other manager you had there when you were playing in Switzerland was Christian Gross.
Yes.
And his reputation in England is based mainly on Spurs, but he was very successful in Switzerland. He won two league titles, Swiss Cup. And he was a big fitness guy, wasn't he, Christian Gross? Did his methods feel different from other managers you played under?
Well, I had a Grasshoppers and we were very successful, okay, you know. We won the leagues, the cup in Switzerland. And Christian Gross was, when it came to Spurs, as I mentioned before, the whole discipline and attitude within the English footballer in terms of fitness and everything is well behind, you know, from David Lloyd's car, not having a fitness gym in terms of within your own facility. Well, he changed that. And for a lot of English players, that was so new. And to accept, actually, you need to have some discipline and some organization with your own body, you know. That was completely new. And some didn't accept it. They didn't like it, of course, because they were free before and doing whatever they wanted to do it, you know. And suddenly somebody come in and say, listen, this is what you have to do. That's what you have to eat. That's the way you have to train. And he was one of the foreign managers like Arsene Wenger and other ones who brought some knowledge and discipline within the English football. Where actually, English football gained a lot, even today, you know.
What the kind of things you're saying that he brought in, what kind of, is there examples of that? And were, are those examples things where I go, well, that sounds common sense? What kind of things is he saying?
I think it's the awareness of looking after your body was not existing within the English mentality as a player.
Yeah.
We were trained from youngster to do that. It was in our DNA, let's call it, okay? And as I mentioned previously on the program, is when I came to England, for me, that was a shock in the system. We have 90% of the English players not even known or knew they have to look after themselves in a very disciplinary way, and in terms of the fitness point of view, have a routine, and also from the diet, you know, not having just fish and chips and you name it, beer, whatever you've been used to be drinking, you know, at that time, you know. That was a huge kind of change for English football, and also an improvement.
I wanted to talk about, like, your managers. As I was looking at your list of managers, you had some, Christian Groves, known for, like, getting the best out of teams physically and working you hard. Then you had George Graham as well. But the guy who signed you for Tottenham was Jerry Francis.
Exactly, correct, yes, absolutely, so, yeah.
who I don't think has that reputation as a hard taskmaster. Is that
no, at all. That's when I joined, exactly what I just mentioned to you. That's my first experience, you know. A player comes 50 minutes before the training session with a cup of tea and a biscuit, you know, and then say, hello, mate, I'm here, I'm ready to do. You know, warmed up, done no wraps, nothing, just put the shoes on and went out. In some stage, I even see he walks out with a cup of tea on the pitch from the dressing room. And I was like, your goodness me, if these guys were in Italy with the coaches we had, where they're super disciplined, he would be not playing for the next 2 months. As simple as that, you know? It's just like, it was the kind of a certain larifari kind of attitude, you know, they call it. But when they're training, they were there. They were just obviously enjoying the game and everything else. But you can see on the long term, there's no doubt there was missing something within the fitness and the discipline within the team. And that's it's today more important than ever, you know?
Did you find yourself moving towards the English way, or did you manage to maintain your own standards? Quite a conservatively phrased question there.
I think after 25 years, I can consider myself a fish and chip person now. No. that's another story. I remember I was injured, and just to come back, you playing some of the reserve team games, you know, just to get the fitness back. So after the game, normally you get food on the first team, you got some banana, oranges, you know, some very healthy, you know, after the game, you have to, you know, refill your energy, you know?
Yeah.
You know. I get a piece of paper, a newspaper, absolute dripping of oil, fish and chips in there. I'm not joking, smelling hell of, the whole bus was smelling with that fish and chip. And it was, the oil was actually dripping below. And I could not believe I'm going to eat that. And I was so starving because after 90 minutes, it actually, so hungry, you eat anything. I was sick as a dog for 2 days after that. I'm telling you that. No clue. So that shows you, and there was no care in terms of the diet side point of view in those days, you know. And that, of course, over a period you're adapting, you need to adapt because you're a team member. But for me, they would look at me prior to the games, that I came with my Swiss muesli, my yogurt, my banana, all that. And look at me, I was an alien. I remember the Newcastle away game. I nearly was sick from the smell of the fry-up. They were eating at breakfast. I said, hey, I can have a fry-up at 3 o'clock as a kick-off. They were looking at me with my natural yogurt, my banana, my muesli. I had pulled action for me, you know. They were looking at me like an alien. Come on, what are you eating there? What is that? What is that? And they were just munching into that bacon, beans. Oh, goodness me. It was smell. Even I think after even a hangover, you couldn't even eat that. It was so smelly. So So that was the 90s, I would say, with English players as well. And for me, it was a totally new experience. And that was part of it, but I couldn't adapt completely because you got for years used to that discipline of eating, obviously, properly. But yeah, I tried a few times. You can see that, the energy level goes down straight away because it's.
Did they have, like a set lunch you all have together, right? Before the match.
Yes.
And also they have food in the dressing room. Because like we were talking to someone yesterday about like when Ivano Benetti got hit by a chicken in the dressing room. And you're like, I didn't know they had chicken in the dressing room. What kind of food was like kicking around in the dressing room?
Oh, this is another one. Exactly. All this food at that time was so non-diet. There was no energy bars in those days. That's just really starting to come in. I think so, like of late 90s, I feel, you know. So there was some food at halftime. It was obviously sick, even the smell, because the dressing room started to this, as you say, chicken just came out of the oven somewhere. And he said, do we have lunch now? It's halftime, we've got 50 minutes time. How can we eat chicken now? it was very new for us foreigners at the time. You know, Jürgen Klinsmann, it was David Ginola, myself. We were kind of, I suppose we're not so many foreigners, so we only had about 3 or 4 max, you know. Mm. But we were looking at each other sometimes. This is unbelievable because obviously Jürgen Klinsmann come from the German way, attitude is very similar to the Swiss, you know, the discipline, diet and everything. And obviously the flamboyant David Ginola, you know, comes from the French side, you know. But then was also... And they had this culture of and the DNA that growing up as a youth academy, that you actually look after your body and you got also educated what you have to eat and how you prepare your training session and things. And for them, that was also very new as well. And of course, we had eyebrows all the time. It's like, goodness me, how the hell these guys can actually train with this food, you know? So, yeah, it's many new experience, but I'm very glad I had this because at the same time, it was very, I think the English player was so very open-minded in many ways. They had fun. They were, they had certain discipline, but at the same time, they still enjoyed the football, you know, like a little kid in the backyard, you know. And I think that made it special because there were characters, some of them, you know, you can smell even on the warm-up that they were on a night out last night, you know. So warm up next to them, he said, goodness me, I'm going to get 10 yards back you, mate. I tell you what, you smell. So this was a drinking culture, as such in England anyway, because England has a drinking culture, you know, you can't avoid that, you know. But within the football players, I think it was quite a lot at the time, you know.
Is it true that Ginola was smoking at that point?
Oh, yeah, he had all the time, he's fat. even at half-time. Sometimes I roommate with him. I could actually not sleep in the room because he smoked the whole room out, you know. So I need to take the mattresses and I went to the bathroom and slept there. he had the fat all the time, actually, even half time. And it's really.
Sat in the dressing room, just having a fat?
No, obviously not. If it's George Graham, he would just like get home, you know. But he got caught once, you know. He went into the toilet, to the dressing room, and then suddenly, as you can imagine, there's no ventilator. A massive wave of smoke is coming towards the dressing room.
How did he think he would get away with that? That's crazy.
And then the coach said, who the F is that? And he said, everybody guessed, and everybody knew who he's going to be, of course, you know. And he comes out, very French flamboyant. Was it? What's the problem? And everybody look at him, the coach absolutely fuming, and say, what the hell are you smoking now? You need to go out in 10 minutes, you know. But that's the way it was at the time, you know. And in a way, as long as he performed, and sometimes he performed extremely well, of course, on the pitch, and it was great, enjoyable to watch him, you know. But of course, he had his older flamboyant way of having a smoke, you know.
Speaking of flamboyance, and when you signed for Jerry Francis, did you notice his hair?
Yes,
he kept that. Did people talk about it in the dressing room?
Oh no, not just that. At the beginning, I didn't get. Well, because obviously the first one, they're all Cockney language in the dressing room, okay? So all this kind of Essex/Cockney language. I couldn't understand one single word what they're saying, you know? I was just a under-Swiss, naive, kind of English, kind of, yeah, not beginners, quite advanced, but English way learning in Switzerland, not the Cockney way, you know? So I couldn't understand one single word what they were saying to start with. But they were talking about the Barnet, and I say... So, as you can imagine, Barnet in English language, for me, Barnet is in North London somewhere. So I went with the map. Ah, oh, Barnet, is he living in Barnet, Terry Francis? And then Ian Walker just went, Ian Walker, what is Barnet? What's the problem with the Barnet? Is he living there? Mate, that's not Barnet. The Barnet's your hair, mate. And he's like, what? How the heck can you call her Barnet, you know? And so all of that for me was a new language, let's call it, okay? And it was fun to learn new culture, new environment, the English kind of way of humor as well, of course, and the Cockney language, you know, within the dressing room. So it was new. For us, for me personally, it was a great time.
So getting reunited with Christian Gross, then Jerry Francis gets sacked. In comes Christian Gross. You're reunited. And he does this press conference where he pulls out the travel card and says, this is the ticket to my dreams. And it was ridiculed in the press. But was he ridiculed in the dressing room? What did the players say when he did?
Oh, I think he was the start and the end of his career, the Spurs, to be honest. Listen. You need to understand even the Swiss culture as well. Swiss, they're very understated in terms of, they don't would like to show in terms of the capitalism side. You know, they want to show they've got a fancy car and all that stuff. The less to show, the better. That's the way the Swiss mentality works, okay? Obviously, having the English/US, we call it in this case, by England, having Joe that he's coming with a Bentley or the thing, that's not the Swiss way. That they want to come with the people I did choose. So he thought he can translate the Swiss mentality into the English mentality when it's non-existing, especially at Spurs, at car park. I think the cheapest car was a Bentley at that time. And he goes to the tube. And they say, how the hell a manager should come with the tube, you know, with a fan? So he would actually translate that obviously he's humble enough and understatement that he is part of the fans. And that didn't come across the way he wanted to, of course, you know. From that point of view, I think that was his end of his career at Spurs, because the perception of you know, talking like that in Spurs, especially at that time, was not what they wanted to hear, you know. So, it's different. It's different, you know.
Had all the players come to you and gone... Because obviously you've played under him before.
Yeah.
Did they all come to you and you were like, this guy's absolutely brilliant? Before
No, not at all, mate. well, the first thing I heard about it, and this is like funny, Alan Sugar at that time was the chairman.
Did you have much dealings with Alan Sugar?
Yeah, obviously my transfer to start with from Italy, and there afterwards as well. So pretty much, on a week in, week out, he was always there in the dressing room, talked quite a lot with him about the overall team, you know. But when the crisis came in and I needed to have a new manager, then the day before Christian Cruz was appointed, I had no clue he was going to be appointed. So Alan Sugar calls me up at night. He said, oi, Ramon. He said, yeah, Mr. Sugar. What got Christian Cruz? What's he like? I think he was a good manager at Grasshoppers. Can he manage in England? I don't know. Well, it's your new manager tomorrow. So what are you asking me then? And I'm like, goodness me. He said, okay, oh, wow. So I'm already afraid. Then obviously they thought I appointed him because obviously the Swiss connection point of view, of course, you know. So all of that might come in place going forward, you know, but didn't happen. And of course, as I say, Christian Cross brought in a completely different approach, how the attitude and the discipline in the dressing room, and you know, the Gary Mappets, the old-fashioned English players were never dealt that way. For them, they didn't like the way Christian Cruyff was actually doing all of that. But obviously today, that's the norm, what Christian Cruyff was doing. At that time, it was not the norm, you know?
It's an interesting dynamic, because obviously, you're the other Swiss person there. Did he come to you and did he see you as a kind of ally?
Well, it's difficult because politically you have to make sure you're not like the little favour player or the manager. Yeah. So I need to have distance. Of course, it's obvious that the two Swiss guys are there. And also an assistant coach was there as well, Fritz Schmidt, at the time, at the beginning, you know. So, it came to me in terms of, with the players, you know, and ask and question me about all the players as well, of course, you know. So I needed to make sure that I keep my distance. I'm not too close, you know, because obviously the players might even come against you, because that's the way it works, you know. You're the manager's favourite. And I said, no, I'm not. I just want to be a team member, simple as that, you know, and maybe bridging between the manager and you guys. That's the only thing I can do. But it was not easy at the beginning, because obviously they thought immediately, I'm the favourite player, you know.
Yeah, that's a weird one, isn't it? So Christian Gross goes, and then you get George Graham, who...
it was a fresh air, this one. I think George Graham was brilliant, saying they, you know, obviously for Spurs supporters, they didn't like it because it was Arsenal, you know.
Yeah.
But from my point of view, I didn't really care, because when he came in, he really brought the back four. That means me, Sol Campbell, Blake Charleston, Edinburgh as well, and Stephen Carr. We really were a consistent, good defence, and hence we won within the League Cup in 1999, you know. So he was actually, from my point of view, at Spurs, the best manager I had in terms of organisational and tactical as such. He said from day one, immediately say, you back four, you're going to train individually, separately on a daily basis. And that's what we've done.
Because that's the kind of thing they talk about, is him just drilling the back four.
Yes.
There's a rumour, which can't be true, of him at Arsenal getting a rope to tie the back four together in a line during training.
Well, it's not a rumour. It's the way it is, you know.
Is that what he did?
Well, not just like that, but very close, because obviously in the back four, in your view, in room marking, you know, you need to make sure your centre-half is as close as possible with you together, because then you have a much better possibility to defend. The minute you've been brought apart, the whole team comes apart, and the opponent has much more space to go penetrate you. So the closer your four back four are together, the better the wall will be in the back. So that's why you actually train during the session. And that had really a huge impact on the game. We really understood each other blind there afterwards, you know. We knew, right, if I look right, Sol Campbell is there. And if Sol Campbell looks on the left-hand side, I was there. He knows if he misses something, I can back up, you know. And it was that kind of automation in terms of training that you blind trust each other and know each other.
Yeah. And just like the players, you won the League Cup in 1999. And some of the players you played with at Tottenham were amazing. Obviously, you mentioned Klinsmann, but, what, you know, David Ginola, Tim Sherwood. You had Les Ferdinand there, and you Sol Campbell in defence as well. So actually really big egos, but fantastic players in that dressing room.
Oh, yeah, we had absolutely fantastic team and players, very quality players. Most are international, as you say, English international as well. Well, I play against them at the Euro 96 as well, like the Teddy Sheringham, the Les Ferdinand, Darren Anderton, and so on, you know. And then obviously on the international level, you've got Jürgen Klinsmann, top striker in the world, David Chunel as well, best player the year at the time in France as well. We had some absolutely quality players, but also characters. That's the thing, the individuality of these players were so charismatic in his own way, where I don't see that today in these young players. They may be extremely talented, the young players today, but the charisma, it's not the same like a David Chunola or potentially Jürgen Klinsmann, or even Les Ferdinand in this case, you know. And that really, to be honest, that marked a little bit the 90s of the players who were playing at that time.
And another name that hasn't come up on this podcast, actually, Jose Dominguez, who I was insanely jealous of when Tottenham had him. I remember for a period thinking he was one of the best players in the world.
He was absolutely...
I'd just like to say I didn't okay that question.
Well, glad that you said that, mate. I didn't say anything, no comment. Tiny little Jose, he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He was, I have to say, gosh, he was, I think, like you, a comedian in the same time, you know, as a player. But he was wimbling around on the left wing. he was fun. He was an entertainer, but not the consistent player. I think he was definitely a player you can second half, last 30, 40 or 30 minutes or so come in and really lift the crowd. And that's what Jose Domingo was actually all about, you know.
So can I just ask, are you going to go on record as saying he wasn't the best player in the world?
Listen, between match players, we don't really, you know, we don't complain about if they're good or not. We just don't say anything, no comments. It's better, mate. Keep it like that, mate.
Another player that was in that Spurs squad was Hans Sagers.
Yes, that's great.
Did you know that he had a business selling his own branded ties?
No, actually, I had no clue about this. No, really?
Oh, yeah, so people email in that there was a brand of ties called Hans Sager's ties that were football themed ties. But he obviously by that point.
Oh, I didn't get a free tie at that time. I would let you know if they're good or not, you know. But I had no clue. It was having. Oh, goodness me, ties. How the heck did he go into the tie business? Oh, God, it's me.
So the high watermark of your time with Spurs is winning the League Cup in 99. But the thing is, you had a stress fracture on your ankle, right? And you played through that final on painkillers. But it kind of, that injury kind of did for you at Spurs, really, didn't it?
Well,
is that fair?
Very much, you know. I was pretty much on the edge of the career ending, let's call it, in stupidly saying if I look back now, all right? I think prior to the League Cup final, and we had a fantastic run with Spurs. We were about 11 games in a row. We actually conceded only about two goals and with the back four. So with defensive line, we were really kind of really going for it. We were also already in the quarters and the semi-finals of the FA Cup as well. And then obviously qualified for the final. So we really like, you know, either one of the cups we're going to win, okay? But prior to that, 2 weeks before, my stress fracture was already there. So I played 2 weeks prior to the final already with that, without knowing it, obviously with major pain. But also the whole kind of winning potentially and being the final at Wembley, I said, no way now, after all these work and playing the quarters, the semi-finals and qualify the final, I'm going to miss now these. No way. Yeah. In my mind, it's not even a question, especially if I look back now. Actually, it's quite unique to win a League Cup with Spurs at the time, you know, because obviously at that time, it was, I think, more than 10 years, I didn't win anything. And then suddenly, I can be potentially one of the winners on that game. And because of the injury, I don't want to miss it. So I went through a major, major painkillers. I'll tell you what, it was absolutely an agony. But it's just my mentality, it's just you want to miss that game. So the final itself, the night before, I couldn't sleep 1 minute, first of all. First of all, I was obviously nervous because of the final. Number two is what happened within 10, 15 minutes into the game. It really, my stress fracture was getting worse when I have to go replace. I let down everybody just because I wanted to be part of it, you know, all of that, you know. So all of that went through my mind before the game, and it was like quite stressful, to be honest with you, if I look back, but also stupidly.
And are you letting people know that you're stressed?
When,
like
you couldn't at that time. In those days, it was not saying, oh, listen, you have to man up, kind of scenario, you know. You don't have somebody to talk, oh, listen, I got this. He used to have Stefan Freund, who at that time was playing with us. He says, you chairman way, go for it. Here's a tablet. Here's a painkiller. Got the final. You know, they're really German, you know, go for it. You know, so, okay, I'll go, do it, you know. And looking back, once you was in that game and then walking up that famous tunnel at Wembley, the old stadium, you know, your mind is set, it's a completely different planet. And just walking out that tunnel and 80,000 watching the whole atmosphere, the bus you're getting through your mind and body, you actually forget you have a major injury.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
The adrenaline of the occasion.
Yeah, the adrenaline, how much the mind can actually play with you with the pain. But after 60 minutes, that's where really started the pain coming in. Because it really is like, wow, I can't do that anymore. And we've seen I think it was 0-0, and I think about last 70 or 80 minutes or something, Alan Nielsen scored. And it was like something came down completely. It was painful the last 5 minutes, completely. And then next day, I needed to go to the Swiss national team, to the doctor. So I fly into Switzerland. So I said, well, I got to Finland. We won the league, blah, 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 cup and everything else. All kind of buzzing, of course. Going to do the scan, the results come back straight away. And the Swiss doctor said to me, Ramon, it was very silent. And I said, what is it? Tell me, doctor. I thought something bad's coming up. It's definitely going to come up. Well, you are absolutely crazy. You are. He had a stress fracture and an ankle broken, and it's been broken for more than 3 weeks. Said something yesterday.
Oh, wow.
Been 3 weeks you've been playing with that. And to be honest with you, I don't know if this is going to be healing back for the next 6 weeks, if you're lucky.
Oh, my word.
Wow. So from the up and major adrenaline winning the League Cup the day before and having absolutely buzz, oh, fantastic. You know, everybody's calling you, congratulating you on a different level. Absolutely shattered in 1 second.
Oh,
I thought my whole career was gone in one minute. So I was hoping for 6 weeks that out, because you need to make sure if the bones heals together. Lucky enough, he actually done it at the time. But at that time, I thought the whole career was finished. And I was not even 28, 29 years old at that time, you know?
That's mad.
So, So that was, and I look back, yes, I was potentially maybe a little bit stupid to go into it, because obviously I knew there was something wrong, but I didn't want to acknowledge.
Yeah.
And really potentially even break your whole career, because you potentially had another 3 to 6 or 4 years of playing, if you're healthy, of course, you know, and go through, do that to your body. But at the end of the day, if I look back now, I can talk about it. When I have a medal, where it spurs for having a medal is a rarity.
Yeah. Do you know what? We've spoken to some Spurs players, or with Jamie Redknapp. He hasn't got a medal, has he? From Spurs.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He's not a Spurs player. I got one. You know? Whatever you're playing, whoever you're playing for, the only thing is in talk about your career is not how many caps you potentially played, is what medals you actually have. And that's the legacy stays forever.
Ferdinand in the corner, and that's where he'll want to keep the ball. He won't care where he goes. He's gone out for a goal kick. And maybe when the ball's in flight here, the referee will choose that moment to blow the final whistle. Martin O'Neill waving everyone upfield. That's it. It's all over. The 1999 Worthington Cup Final has ended in victory for Tottenham Hotspur. The winning goal in stoppage time by the Danish international, Allan Nielsen.
But one place you won a lot of medals was Celtic. Is that the fondest period of your career?
Yes. If you look back there, that was a good question. After having this, obviously, tremendous experience winning the League Cup, and then having that major downside of having a huge injury, or potentially my, not know if I come back. It took me nearly 9 months to come back off that injury. It was a huge lift for me. They were joining such a massive club like Celtic Glasgow. And great characters, the Chris Suttons, Alan Thompson.
Was Chris Sutton? You say Chris Sutton's a great character. He's now a pundit in the UK, in England.
Yeah.
And he is scary. He seems scary.
Well, he was already that dressing room there. He's a very outspoken guy. He takes to make a kind of, in the dressing room, even on a joint Celtic, he was already trying to take the Mickey of you at the dressing room within 1 hour, frankly, you know. But he's a great guy, and there's a fantastic guy on top of that. But he's a, you know, smart guy, I would say, as well, you know. And yeah, he's a character, and we had some great characters, Celtic, Lil Lennon, Paul Lambert, obviously the legend Henrik Larsson in the front.
It's a really good team, actually, isn't it? It's a really strong team. Fantastic.
And again, it's some of the things in the career. I think I look back, I joined them on a Friday night. On the Saturday was a game against Aberdeen. And I not even trained 1 minute with them. I just joined them straight to the hotel where they're, before the game, they're staying, you know. I don't even knew all the names, frankly saying. I thought, that's it. I'm not going to go to the first game. I might be on the bench because I never trained with the lads, you know. Don't even know the names. Some of them, yes, some not, you know. So Martin O'Neill arrives to Celtic Park, where it's an unbelievable experience, Celtic Park. The Celtic fans is a different level. It's just goosebumps just talking about it. And when you're playing with these support, it's a different level. I think it's one of the best, I would say, in the world in terms of support, the passion. It's beyond of that. And again, coming back to the first game, I joined them, thought, no way I'm going to play in my mind. It's impossible. I didn't train with them. How can I do that, you know? So about an hour before, Martino comes in, and then, as usual, he just puts the list, who's playing, and my name is up. And I went to Martin, are you sure? What do you think I brought you here? To watch the game or what? Well, I don't even know the guys. And then suddenly, an hour of preparation mentally, my mind, talking to all the mates, or future mates in this case. I don't even know the names. I need to focus my centre-half partner. Who is his name? Who is it? How is he playing? And I tell you what, I went into, within 10 minutes, I was like part of that team for the last 4 years. Within 20 minutes, I scored the first goal. Within 30 minutes, I scored 2 goals on my first debut.
Amazing.
So pretty much my start at Celtic was done. That's it. Simple as that. Nothing else can actually take me away from that, you know. And it was the best time ever, I would say. In my career, I think it's definitely one of the biggest highlights in my career.
Up goes Ramon Vega. There he is! What a start! He made it clear as he wandered forward, Ramon Vega, that he wanted the ball played to him, drifted away from his marker, and as easy as you like. He's only been a Celtic player for 18 minutes in terms of on-field action, and this is his first goal for the club.
What was Martin O'Neill like? Was he nice? Was he scary?
No, I think, no, really, to be honest with you. He was not the typical manager. It was during the week. He's on the training route. There was Steve Wolford and Robson. They were kind of players, manager, playing with us. But
so you didn't really see him during the week?
So, yeah, he just came on Friday, stands there, looks at him, and then buggers off a little bit. And then that's it. On Saturday, he's there and just puts the team up. And talks about, obviously, the other thing. So he was not the hands-on kind of manager on the day-to-day. He was more kind of psychological side point of view, goes into the players, make sure the players are up to date with what he wants to have on the pitch. And again, these players were all kind of very experienced players, and the mentality was like self-efficient. You don't have to tell them too much. They know what they have to do.
Yeah. Another great Celtic goal scorer, aside from yourself, was, of course, Henrik Larsson. I think in the season you were there, he got 53 goals in all competitions in a single season. What was it? How good was he?
He's the top striker in Europe, and even in that time. Great finisher. He had the instinct as a finisher. It was beyond all the strikers I played with or play against, especially in the Serie A. Obviously Ronaldo is a different level again, because he brings skills and speed and intuitive way of scoring. But Henrik Larsson, the instinct of in the 18-yard box or around it, he was beyond. In the finisher, he was a different planet. Absolutely. For me, it was an honor actually play with him and not against him, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Do you think he was better than Jose Dominguez, Chris Allstars?
Would you put him in that bracket?
You're testing Christopher's knowledge now, isn't it? Don't embarrass him now. He's just podcast, you know what I mean? Come on.
How do you think that Celtic team would have done in the Premier League?
With the team we had at the time? I confidently would be saying top four.
Really?
Yeah. I think we would definitely be competing with the top four, because if you see that team, I left afterwards, they were into the Champions League and they were beating Barcelona, Juventus in the following year. Actually, they went to the finals at Sevilla and play against Porto and lost against them, you know. So the team was extremely strong, there's no doubt. So if you ask me, we will be the top four in Premier League.
So we have a feature on the show called Do I Remember This Right? Where we're basically trying to address rumours that listeners have heard or things they think they remember. And so we've got a couple here. The first one, did you used to co-own a jewellery shop in Romford called Ministry of Gold?
Of course.
That's true.
Well, that's what, of course. Well, it was my job.
What were you working in there? Job.
No, I was not working there, but it was my shop, you know. I was this was one of my first kind of English first investments I got into in the jewelry, you know, and watch and industry, you know, completely new. And Romford had good on the high street, I think, was it? It was a good location at the time. And, you know, that my previous business partner, he was in the jewelry kind of business. And then, yeah. That was my first experience, the whole jewellery industry at the end. We're watching the watch, Swiss watch, of course. So first players at the time were buying my kind of Swiss watches from the Rolexes and everything. So before Christmas, I made like kind of a sales speech to all the players. So their missus buying the jewellery, the diamonds, whatever they want to do it. So it was a little bit of a side business at the time. Good experience, I have to be honest, yeah.
That's when you'd have thought Hans Sagers would have mentioned his ties. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's the moment when you think he's got to bring it up at this stage, doesn't he?
Absolutely. That's why I thought he was coming up. Let's do a little mini market, you know, at the training ground. You know, you selling tie, I'm selling some watches, 2-for-1 kind of scenario, discount for the players, you know, and then go on for it. But it was a great experience. And then it was good.
And another listener swears that he went as a child to a Ramon Vega soccer school in Marbella.
Yeah.
True?
I don't know if it was there, but I was definitely there, because that's why after retirement, I was down in Marbella in most of the summer, and there was no soccer schools whatsoever at that time in Marbella. And I thought, this is, you know, these kids were holidaying here, they need to train or play at least during the day. And then we set it up a soccer school then, and it was good. I had it for about a good 3 years. We had about a good 1,500 kids going through there to school. It was good. Good fun.
Now, we always end with the same question about the 90s. Chris, would you like to end with
our final question, Ramon? If I gave you the opportunity to go back to the 1st of January 1990 and do it all over again, would you?
Yes. Not even a question mark. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I think the 90s was very special in terms of enormous quality players in one moment, you know, not just 1 year or 2 years. It was 10 years of really kind of enormous, a major list of big players were playing in different top leagues, you know, where you don't have that today, to be honest with you. We're still talking about Messi and Ronaldo. In the 90s, we had about 20 of these players.
And they're all smoking.
Oily fish
and chips.
Diego Maradona, we're obviously a different level, of course, you know. I mean, the credit card lines, you know. But these characters and quality of fundamental playing, they're not there. It's not being produced. And this is coming back to this exactly comment I was just saying before. The grassroots level point of view, it's been more and more neglected.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Ramon. Yeah. I genuinely, you talk to people, it's amazing just to talk to someone who's got clearly such fond memories and kind of speaks so kind of positively about what an amazing experience your career must have been. So thank you for that. It's been an absolute pleasure.
You're more than welcome. Absolutely more than welcome. Pleasure.
And it's always nice to hear a little more about Jose Dominguez.
Before we go, normally we do a quiz here. We've been sent a quiz, so I'd like you two to play it. How's that sound?
Yeah, sounds good.
If you've got your own 90s football quiz, do send them in. This is from Ian Hughes of Liverpool. So you're going head-to-head, guys. Thought I'd share a little game involving 90s footballers that I would play with a former flatmate. The game basically involved naming players who, for every reason, are synonymous with having a moustache. Essentially started when I saw a picture of Ian Rush without one, and our brains simply couldn't compete. His trademark facial hair. From this, we began naming players who we think should have a moustache, followed by the question, Muzzy is it? As in moustache, is it? Should they have a moustache? This would often confuse the hell out of people sitting near us in the pub, as we seemed to only be babbling of 90s football players without using any other words. So the conversation would go, John Walk, Muzzy is it? Yes. David Seaman, Muzzy is it? Yes. Rudy Voller, Muzzy is it? Yes. Dion Dublin, Muzzy is it? No. So the way I'm going to play it is you two play Muzzy is it? And I'll say yes, and it's the first one who I say no to. Okay?
Yeah.
So you need to say a player followed by the word Muzzy, is it? And I'll say yes. First person to leave two lose two lives is out. Chris, begin.
So we're just naming players from the 90s who had a moustache.
Who you think, yeah, you picture with a moustache.
Okay, Graham Souness.
Then you've got to say it.
Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
So do I? Am I looking for a yes answer? Is that the rules?
Yeah, you're looking for a yes answer. They don't have to. They could be 80s as well.
Okay.
Or 2000. They could be anywhere from there. Okay. Anywhere, from old present day.
Okay. Rudy Voller, Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
John Walk?
Go on, say it.
Muzzy, is it? Sorry.
Yes.
I'll get the hang of this in a minute.
David Seaman, Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
Oh. Loro, Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
Philippe Albert, Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
I'm
going to have to start rushing you in a minute.
Okay. So. Neville Southall, Muzzy, is it?
Yes.
The beards count, or is it just moustaches?
Just moustaches.
God, it's hard when you're on the spot.
3, 2, 1. Life lost for Michael. Chris, back to you.
Jimmy Greaves, Muzzy, is it?
Oh, come on. How far back? What the fuck?
Hey, mate, he's one of the faces of 90s football.
You can go as far back as you want, Michael.
Okay, fucking Herbert Chapman, Muzzy, is it?
No, he didn't have a moustache, did he?
Socrates, Muzzy, is it?
Yes, I'm taking it.
Have we said David Seaman, Muzzy, is it?
Yeah, we have.
Oh, have we had Ian Rush, Muzzy, is it?
No.
Ian Rush, Muzzy, is it?
Yeah.
Can I just say, Ian Rush is another man who shaved his moustache off and he still doesn't look right without it.
Yeah.
You're destroying your own brand.
Yeah, totally. I don't know how much the Ian Rush brand is worth in 2021, but... Michael, are you out?
I think I'm out.
Two.
Yeah.
Oh. The only ones I could think of were John Aldridge, Muzzy, is it? And Alison, Muzzy, is it?
I was refusing to go too far outside the 90s remit.
Yeah, fair enough.
There was one... when I try to think of 90s footballers with moustaches, there's one player who played for QPR. I think he was like a right back.
Gary Penrice?
Is that who I'm thinking of?
Email in. You Muzzy, is it? Chris, how would you like
Gary
to end the
Gary
show?
Penrice. Can we end the show with, I'm trying to think of famous pop stars with notable moustaches, Freddie Mercury, and Don't Stop Me Now.
Robbie Slater.
See you later.
Good time, having a good time. Shooting star leaping through the sky.